This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, after 7 years, Teresa Younger has announced that she'll be resigning from Connecticut's Permanent Commission on the Status of Women. She'll join us for a last interview before taking on a new role as executive director of the Ms. Foundation for Women. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in 2006 in Garcetti versus Sabalos found that when it comes to making work-related statements, public employees are not protected by the First Amendment. Justices are now revisiting that 2006 ruling as they hear yet another case concerning the constitutional rights of public employees, Lane versus Franks. This morning, we'll start off with a look at both these cases and what they mean for workers with public sector jobs. In a bit, we'll also talk with Dan Schwartz, who writes the Connecticut Employment Law blog, who's a partner at Chipman and Goodwin, about some of the other employment law-related things that have happened during this last legislative session, just ended. We'll take your phone calls as well, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. But first, I want to bring in David Savage, who is a Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Maybe you can explain these two cases for us so that our listeners understand, as I put in our introduction to the program, the Garcetti versus Sabalos case is one that probably a lot of people who aren't public sector workers didn't pay a whole lot of attention to back in 2006. It seems now that as the court essentially revisits that case in a new case, some members of the court are a little bit concerned about what the ruling is back then. Maybe you can walk us through exactly what happened in 2006 and what case they're considering today.
Okay, the Garcetti versus Sabalos case was a dispute that arose in the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office over what one lawyer thought was a sort of a shoddy search warrant application that a policeman got. And this attorney, Mr. Sabalos, objected and said, you know, I think the defense attorneys are right in this case, is that our policeman did not really have probable cause to get this search warrant, and we shouldn't, lie to magistrates about what the evidence is. Anyway, he made his complaint to some people in the office, and they disagreed. They didn't agree with him, but then he decided to go ahead and help the defense attorney in a case and testified that he thought the search warrant should not have been granted. And then he was sort of demoted. And the question was, he said, I was demoted because I spoke out on a matter of public concern, that is honesty in the police department, and I got demoted for it. The case eventually got to the Supreme Court, and there was a 5-4 ruling that really cut back on the notion of what First Amendment rights that public employees have, because the court said, a public employee is not protected for speaking about matters that he learned in the course of his official duties. So if you think you're a whistleblower and you speak out because of something you learned about in your agency, the court's saying you're not protected by the First Amendment.
But before we get to this new case, sure. Maybe you can help us understand something, though. In your reading or other readings of that ruling back from 2006, is there a sense that because this was a police case, that it had to do with law enforcement, that maybe had something specific to do with this ruling about what you learn on the job?
No, not really. I mean, I do think that the justices in the majority viewed this as a workplace dispute. And that in almost every workplace, people have different, disputes. And they viewed it in that, that this person was not speaking on a matter of great public concern as a citizen. He was speaking as an attorney in the district attorney's office. And so they were very much inclined to limit the First Amendment rights of public employees. Now, the case that's pending now is an example of just how far that rule goes, and maybe they're going to pull back a little bit in this case. The new case arose in a community college in Alabama. A fellow named Edward Lane was appointed to head some program involving working with at-risk youth. He discovered that there was a state representative on the payroll who was drawing a salary and doing nothing. And he said to the representative, we can't continue this. You've either got to do work or I'm going to cut you off. She didn't do any work. He cut her off. And she then threatened to cut the budget of the community college system. And lo and behold, Mr. Lane was then terminated. So he filed a lawsuit essentially saying he was terminated for that reason. And during the time the case was pending, The FBI investigated this, and he twice testified that just what happened, that this representative really was not doing any work. She was prosecuted. And so he contended, look, I did my duty as a citizen. I testified when called upon, and I was essentially fired for it. And that should be, you know, the First Amendment should certainly protect that.
And testified when called upon. He's subpoenaed to testify. What's he supposed to do, right?
That's exactly what Chief Justice Roberts said during the argument. What could an employee do in a situation like this? If he testifies, he gets fired, you know, but he's compelled to testify.
Hang on for one second, David. I want to bring in Stephen Wormuehl, who's a professor in constitutional law and associate director of the Summer Institute on Law and Government at American University, Washington College of Law. Stephen, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here, John.
So you heard David Savage give us the rundown from the reporter's point of view. Sitting where you sit, what do you think the justices are considering today after hearing the arguments in this latest case? Do you believe that they're going to change something based on the original ruling in 2006?
Well, I think they have to change something because as your exchange with David a minute ago suggested, the outcome for Mr. Lane is just intolerable. I mean, it can't be that by complying with a subpoena, which he had no choice about, that he's subject to being fired and has no First Amendment protection. The thing to remember, though, is that the same five justices who were in the majority in the Garcetti case in 2006 are still sitting on the court, up until now have not expressed a lot of doubt or concern about how their new rule from 2006 was working. So my hunch, and, you know, David's a better reader of these things maybe than I am, but my hunch is that they'll look for a narrow way to make an exception to the Garcetti rule, but I don't have the sense that that this is going to cause them to think, oh, we've made a terrible mistake and we have to go back to the way things were before Garcetti.
Professor, maybe you can explain a little bit what we know about the differences between speaking as a public employee and speaking as a private citizen. Aside from this case, is there any other law that we can draw on to give us that distinction between speech in those two spheres?
Well, sure. There's a couple of things to think about. I mean, first of all, this is not new. We have a long history propounded by the Supreme Court, in part, of saying that public employees don't enjoy the same free speech rights that all other citizens do, at least not completely, not to the same extent. What the court is always considering is the balance between the public employer's ability to maintain an efficient and effective workplace and the individual's interest in speaking on matters of public concern. So before Garcetti, the court had adopted a rule in 1968 that focused on public concern. If a public employee spoke on a matter of public concern, then that employee might have First Amendment protection. Garcetti added this new element in 2006, saying the first question we really should ask is this person speaking in their employment capacity or as a citizen? And if they're speaking in their employment capacity, we're done. The First Amendment doesn't apply. We're finished with the matter. If they're speaking in their capacity as a private citizen, then we still ask, is it a matter of public concern? And then we balance the interests of the employer against the interests of the employee and try to figure out who wins. All of that said, there are other avenues. They don't always work. They're not always available. There are whistleblower statutes in many states, and I think that Lane at one point had perhaps raised a state law claim, but when the case went up on appeal, he dropped that claim. So that's one thing to consider there. If it's a federal issue, there's federal whistleblower law. And then many states have whistleblower laws, but not every dispute between an employer and an employee is going to be a whistleblower situation. You're not always talking about exposing the kind of wrongdoing or corruption that the whistleblower laws are intended to cover.
We're talking with Stephen Wermiel, who is a professor of constitutional law at American University in Washington, and David Savage, who's a Supreme Court correspondent for the L.A. Times. We'll take your calls in a moment at 860-275-7266. Let's try to pull apart this very interesting case. And joining us in the studio is Dan Schwartz. He's a partner at Chipman & Goodwin and a blogger for the Connecticut Employment Law Blog. He's our expert on employment law, so we wanted to bring him in to talk this through. Dan, good to see you once again.
Nice to see you, John.
So I guess I'm wondering, first of all, if you can just give me your read on this and maybe pull apart some of the examples here that Stephen's just talking about. This is a very, very tricky idea, and having to do with public employees, private employees, free speech rights, which seem so very clear to us and clearly aren't clear in this case.
Yeah, no, it's a very unusual case, I think, as the other guests have pointed out, because it doesn't seem right to us that an employee who is compelled to testify under a subpoena could be fired for that. There's something I think the justices in their oral argument found disturbing about that. But you can also see other examples of employee speech that, you know, have some questionable application here. So, for example, suppose a employee works for Burger King and says, you know what, I'm going to refuse to serve hamburgers or I'm going to protest the serving of hamburgers to kids because I think it causes obesity in kids. Well, it's a matter of public concern. I think we could all agree with that. But what's the interference with the job? And Connecticut has a very unusual law which applies the First Amendment to private employers. So I think, you know, the applications of these Supreme Court cases, when you get down to private employers in Connecticut and the application of the First Amendment, becomes a very, very interesting issue.
The professor just raised whistleblower laws, which are different in every state, and there's federal whistleblower laws. There's a few different things here. There's the question of whether or not you can speak your mind as a public employee, and then there's another question about exposing some sort of corruption, which is clearly what this Lane case is all about. Could you just lay out for us at least Connecticut's whistleblower law, how that might play in here, Dan?
Yeah, so Connecticut has two different laws. One is the application of the First Amendment to employers, but they have a second law called 3151M, which says that if you complain to essentially the public officials, the employer can't punish you for that. And that's been long understood in Connecticut. And I think you can see in many instances where the employee is outing the employer for some safety violations under OSHA or some other type of safety issue, that's going to be protected. That's above and beyond the First Amendment. That's just plain old whistleblowing.
What else can you tell us, Dan, about the impact that this Garcetti case, this 2006 case, had here in Connecticut?
Yeah, so in a couple of years ago, there's a case, Schumann versus Dianon, which I argued on behalf of the employer, where a lab doctor refused to use certain diagnostic codes, and he claimed it was going to affect patient safety. There was a trial. He won down at the lower court of a verdict of about $10 million. And the Supreme Court of Connecticut came out with a 7-0 decision which says we're going to apply the Garcetti rule, that is that speech that relates to your official job duties is not protected. They threw out the verdict, sent it down to the lower court again for a ruling. And the court in that case sort of looked at an argument that we raised, which is, you know, it would be absurd if every employee could serve as a roving ombudsman, that they would say, hey, what the employer is doing is wrong and I know better, you know, and could overrule the employer. I think the court in that case was troubled by the notion that every speech that an employee raises that has some tangential public interest would be protected.
But then what's the limit? What's the line? If I'm an employee who thinks that my employer is doing wrong, how do I know where the line is that I can walk up to or run up to before I might get fired?
Well, the Garcetti case and the case Schuman versus Dianon sets the rule that basically if it's part and parcel of your concerns to perform your duties, that's not going to be covered. And if you really have a concern, if it's an illegal violation, go to the public agency. You'll be protected as a whistleblower. But I think the court was setting forth some lines that said, you know, if it relates to your job duties, we're just not going to protect it.
Stephen Wormiel, I'd love for you to weigh in on this. This whole idea of where the line is for whistleblowers in Connecticut or any other state or under federal whistleblower laws, that's the sort of thing I think employees would want to know. What am I actually protected for before you start blowing the whistle?
Well, I agree with Dan. I think it's really hard to say that there's a clear line. For example, I'm not sure that Sabalos, even though he felt he was dealing with wrongdoing by a police officer in the lead up to a search warrant, I'm not sure that would qualify or rise to the level of whistleblower activity. So, unfortunately, it really is on sort of a case by case basis. There are standards in the different state laws, but it's ultimately going to be up to a government agency or a judge and jury to decide whether you fit within those standards.
David Savage, before I let you go, where do you see this all going? You were there watching the justices, and I know that Nina Totenberg, who covers all this for NPR, said that she did see some discomfort. Dan Schwartz has already talked about this. What do you think the justices are going to do after reconsidering this?
Well, I agree with what Steve said earlier. I think they will rule for Mr. Lane, but they'll do it fairly narrowly and say that if you're subpoenaed, that's a different thing. I think the only line, John, is that, you know, if you're an employee who works for an agency in Connecticut and you write a letter to the newspaper or someone and say, our state legislature is doing a really bad job, or I really disagree with the governor on this or that, the First Amendment would say you can't be fired for that because you're just speaking out as a citizen. But almost everything that goes directly to your job, your workplace, I think the Supreme Court's going to stick with the view that the First Amendment doesn't protect you to speak out on things you learn at work.
When you work for the state government, though, there's an awful lot that falls into the category of what your job is. Or am I wrong about that?
You're not wrong about it. I mean, I think a lot of people would think as a matter of common sense, if you learn something really important in your agency, you ought to speak out and be protected for doing it. But that's not the Supreme Court's view. They tend to view these things as workplace disputes, and we're not going to allow them to be turned into federal court cases.
David Savage is a Supreme Court correspondent for the LA Times. David, thank you so much for your expertise. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
Thanks also to Stephen Wormiel, who's a professor in constitutional law at American University. Thank you, sir.
Glad to join you. Thanks, John.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about employment law with Dan Schwartz. Dan is partner at Chipman and Goodwin, and he runs the Connecticut Employment Law Blog. We'll take a look at some of the things that the state legislature considered over the course of this last legislative session. We'll talk more about the Supreme Court case if you'd like at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're considering employment law today on the program with Dan Schwartz, who's a partner at Chipman and Goodwin. He runs the Connecticut Employment Law Blog. We've been talking a little bit about a Supreme Court case that the court is hearing, sort of a confounding case. If you have questions, 860-275-7266, and we'll get back to some more things from the legislative session. Just quickly before we move on from this topic, I guess we're talking about both federal law and also Connecticut law. You would raise the question of the Connecticut Constitution, whether or not there's a different standard for free speech here in Connecticut.
Yeah, so one of the questions that wasn't answered by the court that was sort of punted by the court in the Schuman case is, does Connecticut's constitution, which has an independent free speech right, is that differ from the U.S. Constitution? And the court said in the Schuman case, they didn't have to decide that issue in part because even under the Connecticut constitution, the speech wouldn't be protected. But courts now in the last couple of years looking at this issue of First Amendment, the lower courts are now split as to whether Connecticut Constitution is broader than the U.S. Constitution. So I think we're likely to see over the next year or two a case up at the Connecticut Supreme Court that has to look at, you know, it does the free speech rights under the Connecticut Constitution, are they broader, and does the Garcetti rule that's been applied still apply in Connecticut?
Not to make this too much of a sports analysis like they do on ESPN, but do you feel like free speech for employees is moving forward or backward? Are employers on the defensive or employees on the defensive right now?
No, I think clearly over the last 10 years, the employees are on the defensive. I think for a long time, and prior speaker, the professor spoke of it, you know, in 1968, the court really expanded the speech for free speech rights under the old letter to the editor rule. Well, you know, in today's modern workplace with Facebook and everything else, the letters to the editor are a little bit of an outdated notion. But, you know, with Facebook and Twitter, the places where employees can speak is really broad. And I think courts have been restricting those rights over the last 10 years. Whether we'll see a real expansion of that in the Lane case from the U.S. Supreme Court, I think the prior speakers are right. I don't see it as a big expansion.
I just think it's really interesting you raise Facebook and Twitter. It's one thing to make this case about, you know, a guy who gets subpoenaed and whether or not he's supposed to testify truthfully in court. It seems like a fairly obvious thing. But then there's going to be a million little cases about someone who gets fired because of something that he wrote as a comment on Facebook. Not necessarily a letter to the editor, not necessarily a letter to his boss, not stomping into somebody's office and waving his arms around. It's just somebody typing a little something maybe innocuous late at night on Facebook.
Oh, I think that's it's an issue I'm fascinated with because we don't have any answers on that. But I think if you're going to apply the First Amendment to the letters to the editor, why doesn't it apply in the modern context to Facebook? The employee is putting it out there. They're speaking on a matter of public concern. Perhaps they're saying they don't like something that Governor Malloy has been doing. Why isn't that speech also protected in the same way?
Let's talk about some of the things that did happen during the state legislative session. I know you've been writing about them at your Connecticut Employment Law blog, something that people should read if indeed they want to learn a little bit more about this world. Paid sick leave is something that came up in the legislature a few years back. It got addressed again during this legislative session?
It did. I think whenever you come out with a law that's paid sick leave was really new and novel, there were some issues that came up that didn't quite fit in terms of its application to employers. So employers have been asking for little fixes, and employees have been asking for some fixes as well. So there were a few fixes that were made that basically said instead of calculating paid sick leave based on a calendar year, you can look at it over any other 365-day period. That'll make calculating paid sick leave much the same as paid time off. Many employers do it on a fiscal year basis, or Family Medical Leave Act, which allows employers to look back over a prior year as well.
I remember when this law was first passed, that differentiation that it had to be over a calendar year, that was one of those little things that I think I even had you on the program and we thought to ourselves, boy, yeah, that could cause some problems with HR, couldn't it?
Yeah, it was just one of those things that I don't think was fully thought out. And then once you see its application, even when you would talk with people from the Connecticut Department of Labor, they would say, look, just do the best that you can, because you were trying to fit that old proverbial square peg into a round hole. So that was one good fix that I think that was made. Another fix that was made was this paid sick leave applies to employers who are 50 employees or more. Well, under most of the laws, you calculate that based on how many employees you have on October 1st. Under the paid sick leave law, the old paid sick leave law, you had to do it on a quarterly basis, and it was very confusing. So this new rule makes it consistent with the other laws that are out there and says 50 or more employees on October 1st.
Okay, so now that these consistencies are there and maybe they'll get a chance to bake in a little bit, I know at the time there were a lot of concerns from some in the business world who said, this is going to drive people out of jobs. We're going to have to spend all this money on paid sick leave. Any of those dire warnings come to pass? I mean, what are you hearing from employers?
You know, I think as with any new law, there's an adjustment period. But I think overall employers have adjusted to the law. And I think in part what they realized is if we give some employees, 5 days off of paid time, that's going to cover it. So the fix that some employers really applied is, instead of looking at this calculation of paid sick leave, if they gave employees at least a minimum of 5 days off that employees could use for sickness, for other types of absences, that was going to cover it. And so I think that's the change that we've seen, and employers adjusted to it.
It really wasn't that hard, was it?
Well, you know, I think every prediction of a law has its pluses and minuses. And you hear the same thing as I know we'll talk about in a minute on minimum wage. And yet we see adjustments that happen over time as well.
We will bring up minimum wage in just a little bit. And later on in our program, we'll be bringing in Teresa Younger, who's leaving her post at the Permanent Commission on the Status of Women. That's something she's been talking about quite a bit. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. So another thing the legislature took up, another hot topic here in Connecticut, has to do with HR and what HR exactly controls as far as personnel records. Can you explain a little bit?
Yeah. So over the last couple of years, we've seen increasing amounts of legislation to make sure that employers and companies in general protect personnel data. So several years ago, we've seen information that was Social Security information that employers were required to protect and take steps to destroy once employees have left. So I think we're seeing as a general trend the legislature is increasingly concerned about data privacy. We didn't see any major landmark bills this particular legislative session, but I think we'll continue to see employers being held responsible for the data that they have. You know, the classic example that we've all now heard about over the last 6 months is the Target data breach of these credit card numbers. I think that really raised eyebrows and raised the attention of a lot of people that said, hey, we really need to do a better job protecting information. Employee data is really an area that, as we've been moving personnel files from a paper to an online form, employers need to take better steps to protect that information, much in the way that they do the credit card numbers of their employees or of customers.
Well, here's one of the interesting things, though, is we talk about whether it's a new law like the minimum wage going up to 10-10 or paid sick leave, something that a lot of employers said, this is going to cause us problems. Mandates like these, the ones that have to do with controlling information, okay, that's very expensive, and it's a big moving target, and you don't necessarily know that you're doing it right. When it comes to mandates that come down from government about what employers have to or don't have to do, it seems like that's one that's actually a really big deal.
It is. And, you know, in when you talk with the Attorney General's office, they will tell you that the biggest change that they made was simply the requirement that companies need to notify them of data breaches. And once they did that, they saw the reporting of those data breaches go up significantly. So I think it really forced companies to pay attention to their data. And it's an increasing amount of concern. And I don't think some employers have really understood how over the last couple of years with mobile phones and tablets, how the data has really been seeping out there in a much more dramatic fashion than 10 years ago when you could put up a firewall at your office and, you know, you were essentially protected.
Let's go to the phones. Maggie is calling from Brantford. Hi there, Maggie. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question concerning paid sick leave. My husband is an Amtrak employee and gets a ton of vacation time because he's been there for 30 years, but gets no sick time. And I'm kind of confused with this because is this because there's a union and the union's negotiated that? Does it matter? Amtrak has well more than 50 employees.
Sure. So Amtrak, I think, falls within those special types of employers that aren't covered, mainly because they're a quasi-public agency. So the Connecticut's rule really just applies to Connecticut employers that have 50 or more employees. Manufacturers have been exempt from that, but Connecticut's paid sick leave is much more narrow than simply applying to everyone everywhere who has an employee in Connecticut.
But Maggie, so before I let you go, so your husband doesn't get any sick time at all?
No, no sick days at all. He does get vacation, a substantial amount of vacation time because he's been there for 30 years. but those vacation days cannot be taken singly just on a whim. You need to put in for your vacation time in January, and you can't just take a single day, say, in July because you don't feel well. If you don't work, you don't get paid.
Maggie, thank you very much for raising that question. And Dan, are we at the federal level or as a country, do you think that we're moving toward this idea that paid sick time for all workers is something that's going to be on the table, even for Maggie's husband?
You know, until we see a dramatic change in Congress's makeup, we haven't seen any laws coming out on a federal level that relate to employment law over the last 4 years. Nothing is getting through. So you're not seeing the federal minimum wage. You're not seeing the expansion of family medical leave. So I think where we're seeing these issues come up now are at state levels. We've seen New York City implement paid sick leave, for example, or states have been implementing various employment laws on social media policy access. But we're not seeing it now at a federal level in a way that we really haven't seen in a generation. Even in the times where the legislatures, the federal legislatures were split, there were some compromises that passed. Family Medical Leave Act was a classic example, and we're not seeing any of that right
now. Well, look, we're seeing nothing getting done in Washington. I guess I just wonder, because I have you here. I mean, we started off by talking about the Supreme Court. Can you foresee an instance where something like paid sick time actually rises to the level of a court intervention that somehow or other it is deemed, maybe not by this court, unconstitutional that indeed you don't have any sick time to take care of your kids or yourself?
Yeah, no, I think where we'll see it is the sort of expansion of the family medical leave and the notion that you can take time off to care for a family member or care for yourself and that, you know, larger employers can really handle that. You know, it's been 20 years since Family Medical Leave Act was passed. I think employers have adjusted real well to it. So I think once you have states that have shown that you can implement, for example, paid sick leave and it doesn't dramatically impact the workplace, I think those examples will then get into the notion that we can pass a federal law to do the same thing.
We've just got a minute left or so, and we're going to bring in Teresa Younger to talk about the impact of the new minimum wage law on women in the state. But I'd like to get your take, working with employers and employees. What do you think the impact is going to be of this new 10-10 minimum wage in Connecticut?
You know, clearly we're going to see some adjustment periods. You know, we're going up from right now, we're at 870. We're going to 10-10 in a matter of 3 years. You're going to see some fallout from that. Employers are going to want to control costs in some way. Maybe we'll see some increased use of technology to supplant some of the jobs that had of people. But I think the hope is that in a growing economy, which I think people are hopeful for the next couple of years, that any losses that might play in will be offset by gains in the other part of the economy. You know, I think the research is still somewhat split on whether increases to minimum wage have huge job losses associated to them, because employers still need employees, society ends up adjusting to it as well. But when you have the disparity of that, Connecticut's going up to 10-10, and you've got states that are still at the federal minimum wage. How that plays out, we haven't seen that in a long time.
Looking at the way this law is drawn up and the phase-in over the course of the next 3 years, we talked about fixes already to paid sick leave. Do you see some things in this law that already will require Connecticut to go back and say, well, let's clarify this for employees, what we mean by a minimum wage, who exactly it's for, and when it's instituted?
Not necessarily. I think we've sort of adjusted to the minimum wage notion in Connecticut, and there are certain exceptions. So, for example, someone who's under 18, their first 200 hours, they can get paid 85% of minimum wage. So those types of exceptions had worked well. And, you know, the notion that an increase in wage helps everyone, I think there's a lot to be said for that. So I don't see that we'll have any big changes coming about from the legislature as a result of it.
Dan Schwartz is a partner at Shipman and Goodwin. He runs the Connecticut Employment Law Blog, which you can read along if you want to find out more about some of the topics that we've been talking about today. Dan, always good to see you. Thanks.
Thanks, Sean.
We're going to be talking with Teresa Younger coming up next. She's leaving the Permanent Commission on the Status of Women for a new exciting job. We're going to talk to her about the status of women in Connecticut next, where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, there are many things that divide our cities and suburbs in Connecticut, but it usually isn't a physical fence. But 5 decades ago, a fence was built between New Haven and Hamden to separate suburban homeowners from crime-ridden public housing complexes. Well, that wall is coming down. We'll get the story from the New Haven Independent's Paul Bass. That and other stories coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Teresa Younger is Executive Director of Connecticut's Permanent Commission on the Status of Women. She was introduced as the new Executive Director of the Ms. Foundation for Women last Thursday. She's going to be leaving this commission, and we've talked with her a number of times over the years, so we want to congratulate her on her new job and also welcome in for a bit of an exit interview. Teresa, good to see you once again.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
So before we get to what you're doing in your job now, I'd like to ask you about the Permanent Commission on the Status of Women. It has often seemed not all that permanent, something that perhaps is always under threat from legislative cutbacks or some sort of problems with the budget. Do you see this as something that has to move forward in Connecticut?
I think that we're going to need a Permanent Commission on the Status of Women for a while longer.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the conversation about how much value do we want to place on having informed legislators and policymakers is a good and valid conversation. But I think it distracts from the real realities of what needs to be happening in the legislature. You know, every time they're worrying about the 32 cents for every taxpaying woman in the state of Connecticut that gets allocated to the PCSW's budget. I mean, you're talking about 5 full-time staff people and a budget of just over $600,000. And, you know, in a budget of $19 billion, you know, it's really a small percentage of what happens. And what we do is do gender-based, Connecticut-based research to inform policymakers about what the laws they're thinking of passing and how they're going to affect women and their families in the state of Connecticut. And you just don't get that from reading what happened in Texas or reading about what happened in Alaska. If you want to pass policy that helps Connecticut families, then you need to understand how those policies are going to affect Connecticut families from a nonpartisan staff that are helping to work on the issues.
What are some of the successes you've seen in doing just that?
Well, you know, some would debate whether they're successes, but I actually think that what you were just talking about, earned paid sick time, is a huge success for many people. And here in the state of Connecticut, we've been on the forefront of lots of those kinds of conversations around family-friendly workplace policies that help Connecticut's families. And I think, you know, we've seen from earned paid sick time, which I personally think is a good thing, to marriage equality, which the PCSW has talked about, to making sure that we have strong child support laws that ensure that primary caretakers can care for their children, to increasing the minimum wage in the state of Connecticut. I think all of those things help with the economic stability of women and their families in the state of Connecticut. I would also say, you know, we have some of the most comprehensive reproductive rights legislation in the country. And we also have some real strong legislation on the books to help with women who are involved in sexual assault and domestic violence.
It's interesting you mentioned those last two things because I wanted to talk about that a little bit. It seems as though the conversation around women and issues that are very, very important to them has changed slightly over the course of the last couple of years. And I don't know if that's reality or just sort of what we've seen in the press. But we've seen more and more about pocketbook issues. I think we've seen more and more about the need to have women, certainly those who are leading households, have an ability to actually make a living wage. And also sexual assault is a huge issue on college campuses right now. So much of the conversation over the course of the last couple of decades has been about reproductive rights. And I guess I'm wondering from where you stand in the job that you're leaving, the job you're going to now, whether or not that has been through a lot of people deciding to change the subject a little bit, whether or not we've spent too much time talking about reproductive rights at the expense of getting, you know, pocketbook issues for women at the forefront of what we're talking about here.
Well, I mean, I think we're at a very different point in our society. I think there was a point at which people were only talking about reproductive rights for women because that's where the conversation drove itself. And I think as we've seen more women have access to education, more access to their own reproductive health, and the ability to make more decisions, we are seeing the pocketbook impact of the freedoms and rights women have to make decisions over their bodies and the long term, what that looks like. It's very different to have a pocketbook conversation about when you can't control your own reproductive health and how many children you're going to have and what that needs to look like. When you can make those decisions and you look at them over the long run, I think what we really are seeing is that women have a broad spectrum of opportunities that have come before them. We're getting educated at higher rates, and we have real voices in real conversations, and we are seeing more women in more places. And I guess I would say the reality is women are making 80% of purchasing decisions in their households. And people understand that conversation. I mean, the market is gearing their, you know, targeting women in their decision making, and I think that's really important. But I think it shows the spectrum of what women's issues are.
But just to put it another way, do you think that given that we would be further along in the other kind of 80% issue, which is women make a little less than 80% of what men make, that we'd be further along in that conversation if we hadn't spent so much of the last 20 years really focusing so much on reproductive rights?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I actually don't think so. Yeah. I actually think, you know, people have to be at different points to hear different parts of the story.
Exactly.
And I think we needed to have that 20 years of having conversations around reproductive health, not just for women, but for men also. And now as households have become more balanced, as couples are making decisions about what they'd like to see, I think we are seeing a greater recognition by both men and women that the conversation's ready to move to something else. And also a recognition that the law of the land is the law of the land. And we need to make sure that we respect that and that we explain that there was a battle to get to the law of the land around Roe v. Wade, but that there are other things that we can work on at this point, too.
We're talking with Teresa Younger, outgoing executive director of Connecticut's Permanent Commission on the Status of Women, introduced as new executive director of the Ms. Foundation for Women last Thursday. So what is the next conversation? As you take on this new role, what's the thing that you think needs to be on the forefront right now?
Wow. You know, I will say what I've always said, John. I don't know that there's any one thing that needs to be on the forefront. I think it's more critical now than it has ever been to stay vigilant to the rights that women have earned thus far and make sure that we are promoting more women in leadership, ensuring that we have real, if the conversation across the country really does talk about the things that we value, and that we continue to speak truth to power when it comes to the issues that are affecting women and their families and men and their families. I know it sounds really broad, yeah, but I can't narrow it down.
But more women in leadership roles, more women heading up colleges, more women in the legislature at the state level, more women in Congress. It seems like those are the things that will actually help change some of the other issues that you care about.
More women in CEO positions.
Yes.
I think it's all across. I don't think it just gets limited to education or to politics. I think the reality is, even in my new position as CEO and president of the Ms. Foundation for Women, we need to have more women as heads of philanthropic institutions that are going to be helping to direct where funding is going to nonprofits, as well as direct what policy decisions may be impacted.
What's a way we get there? Aside from just, you know, one hire at a time, I mean, what's another systematic way we get there?
Well, I think, you know, as we are coming up on 2020, the 100th anniversary of a woman's right to vote, I think we really need to take a look across the board at where is our women's political power, where are men's political power, what does that need to look like, and how do we raise the level of conversation? And so I think right now it's about recognizing that there are so many ways of media, new media and old media, whatever old media is anymore.
It's radio, yeah. That you're on right now, unfortunately. Too bad for us, but please.
There are multiple ways of heightening where the conversation goes. I think we have, as a society, have siloed our conversations, and we need to increase those conversations. And, you know, I'll tell you, last night I have a Girl Scout troop,
yeah,
high school seniors. who are all going to college, young women. And when I was talking to them about my new position at the Ms. Foundation for Women, I recognized that none of them had a clue who Gloria Steinem was.
Mm.
None of them understood that there had been a real woman's movement to ensure equality and that we were still fighting that those battles today. And, you know, so for me, it's about making sure that what young women and young men are completely educated on a on what real history was in this country.
Yeah, I mean, just even the idea of the Ms. Foundation, it's something that maybe resonates with me and you, an older generation than us, a little bit more. But kids today don't understand what the Ms. Foundation, Gloria Steinem, even did. How do we get to that point?
Well, I think it's a, you know, first off, I will say, you know, I love the Ms. Foundation, but it wasn't something that I grew up on. And I think we need to remind people that it was the first women's fund in the country. It was the first time that women came together and said, we are going to prioritize how we impact and support nonprofits in this country. And they put their money where their mouth was. And that led for a change across the country in a variety of different areas. And they helped fund the linchpin of a lot of nonprofits. But I think what happens is we only get told what we get told.
Mm.
And so at this meeting with my Girl Scouts, it wasn't just the girls that didn't know who Gloria Steinem was or who the Ms. Foundation was. Their mothers didn't either. We were having an ice cream social. And so it's about being having safe places to have conversation and to talk about what we think we know and what we don't know and how far we've come. I think we don't want to look back, so we don't look back, and we keep running forward.
But one of the powerful things about this, we just have a few moments left with you, is this idea of a foundation like this being philanthropic, using money to impact change directly. You've spent a lot of time here in Connecticut trying to impact change by talking to lawmakers. And look, I talk to lawmakers all the time, and that has limited utility at times, you know, just telling people what's good and bad. So this is a more powerful role in a lot of ways. You're spending money to do good.
This is a more powerful position. It's a really wonderful opportunity to not just spend money to do good, but to also host a conversation that's been happening here in Connecticut nationally and to engage more people. What we've done in Connecticut at the PCSW, and I think have done very well, is expand how large the table is and who gets to come to the conversation and engage them and convene them in really smart, intelligent, data-driven conversations about how our policies can change and what does this state need to look like. Now I'll be moving to a broader level. I'll be able to really bring more voices to the table. We'll be able to engage what's happening in other states and give a vision in other states about what women's rights really can look like so that they don't get discouraged and put our money where our mouth is.
People who care about women's rights, all the things you just talked about, but also women being able to, you know, have a living wage, women being able to lead a company, we, I think, probably take a lot for granted in Connecticut. I think that there are probably some other states that don't do as well as we do.
Oh, Connecticut, you know, we joked last year when Connecticut was ranked number one. But, you know, when we think about it, Connecticut has an increased and higher than average right now minimum wage. We have a program called Care for Kids. We had expansion towards the Affordable Care Act that ensured more women had access to health care. We have Roe v. Wade codified into our Constitution. You know, Connecticut really is an amazing place to live. It has got a very high education. We are having real conversations about what needs to go on, and other states don't do as well, and they need to.
Teresa Younger, I wish you so much luck in your new role. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have to have you back again. Teresa Younger, the outgoing executive director of Connecticut's Permanent Commission on the Status of Women, introduced just last week as the executive director of the Ms. Foundation for Women. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. Thanks for joining us here on Where We Live.